Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
So this week on Dear Science, we're going to be talking about the COVID-19 vaccines, specifically the AstraZeneca one and the blood clot risk. And we have covered this before with Marcus, but Alan, you're wanting to go into a bit more detail?
Well, not so much detail, but let's go into numbers. Let's talk risk, because that's what this is all about. Now, obviously, everybody listening, I'm sure, knows that there appears to be a small number of people who are having adverse reactions to the AstraZeneca COVID virus in the form of blood clots. And in fact, just overnight, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that's also been hit with this as well. And so the US and the EU and South Africa are now sort of suspending the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine as well. So the question then becomes, well, is this warranted? Is this concern warranted? So Marcus spoke about this last week in sort of general terms. Let's get into specifics. Let's talk about tossing coins and statistics.
Yeah, I was
going to
say
stuff like that.
Statistics, okay? Are my one area of math that I'm actually good at.
So. Oh, shit. Okay, that's not good. Okay, right. So here we go. You toss a coin. What's the chances you're going to get a head?
50-50.
Right. So you've got a half chance, let's say. Okay. So your chance is 1 in 2. Do it twice. What are your chances of getting 2 heads?
One in 16.
Here we go. So you've got two. You're tossing a coin twice. Chance of getting 2 heads. So you could toss it once. You either get a head or a tail. You toss it the next time. You either get a head or a tail. So your chances, well, your choices are 2 heads. Is one possibility of that. A head and a tail is 2 possibilities of that, and 2 tails is 1 possibility of that. So your chances of getting 2 heads in a row, 1 in 4. Okay? 3 heads in a row is, to cut a long story short, is 1 in 8. Okay, so to toss a coin and get 3 heads in a row, statistically speaking, you'll do that 1 time every 8 that you actually try to do it, okay? 4 heads in a row, 1 in 16, 5, 1 in 32, 6, etc., 1 in 64. So it's 1 over 2 to the power of n, where n is the number of attempts that you are having. Okay, right, so what's this got to do with COVID vaccines and AstraZeneca and stuff like that? Well, what they have found is that the incidence of these blood clots with the AstraZeneca vaccine, around about 4 in a million. Okay, so 4 in a million people get these adverse effects, blood clots, and of those, 1 in 4 die. Okay, so, and these numbers are based on the UK up until March the 31st, they had 79 reports of blood clots. And of those, 19 people died, okay? So the risks, given those numbers, basically the risk of getting a blood clot from the AstraZeneca is 4 in a million, which is 1 in 250,000, and the risk of dying from that is 1 in a million. Okay, so let's translate that to tossing coins. And how many heads in a row would you have to toss in order that you're going to be that one person in 250,000 that's going to die, or that's going to get a blood clot, sorry. Okay? Okay, so we've seen, you know, just getting 3 heads in a row, that's only a 1-8 chance. 4 heads in a row, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the 1 in 250,000 possibility means that you would have to toss a coin and get 18 heads in a row. Okay? That's your risk. Your risk that you
think you need like a double head-sided coin to do that.
See, so that is your risk. The risk, 1 in 250,000 of getting a blood clot is the same risk as tossing 18 heads in a row if you're going to toss a coin. Ever tried tossing 18 heads in a row?
No.
I must say neither have I, okay? But you realize that the odds of doing that are, I'm not going to say vanishingly small, because they're not, but they're bloody tiny, aren't they?
I get that they're very, very small,
right?
Odds, but would you say that when you put it in proportion to the amount of people who are going to need/get the vaccine,
No, well, that's the whole thing. That's what everything is based on. So this is this is based on the numbers of people who've actually been vaccinated, and then this is their risk. Okay.
Because you said 19
died. Deaths. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Out of a total of, I'm not sure how many, but I think like it's about 40% of the UK population have had their first COVID shot thus far. So that's small odds. And in terms of dying from that blood clot, then that's another factor of four, okay, because it's one in a million now. So you're going to have to be tossing 20 heads in a row.
Is it smaller than the odds of dying from COVID?
Well, that's the thing. That's the big question. And there you're weighing relative risk, okay? Mm. So if you catch COVID, you've got a... I'm not sure what the numbers are. It might be 1%, I think, 2% something chance of dying of it.
It's about a 2% mortality rate.
Mortality rate. Oh, I like that. Mortality rate, yeah. And so the numbers, you know, basically people have crunched the numbers and they're looking at relative risk versus benefit, okay? You've essentially a cost-benefit analysis if you want to talk about it in terms of, you know, finance and stuff like that. And it's overwhelmingly positive. Okay, that your benefit from being vaccinated and being exposed to this 1 in 250,000 or 1 in a million risk is just, you know, enormous. And you know, somebody asked the question, they sort of say, well, what price can you put on a human life? Mm. And you know, then to which was asked the opposing question. How many people have to die of COVID to justify somebody not getting vaccinated? You know, and that's kind of the reverse way around of asking that question. And, you know, that's sort of the question that we should be asking, really. So something that humans are particularly poor at is sort of gauging relative risk, you know. And 1 in a million doesn't sound like a lot, does it? I mean, even when you say it like that, or you know, the possibility of or the probability of flicking 20 heads in a row when you're tossing a coin, same sort of thing. It's a very, very small number. But then some people just say, oh, you know, this vaccine's got stuff in it and people are dying, you know, people are getting blood clots and they're dying. Yes, they have done. They absolutely have done. But only one person in 1 million, you know. So... And again, overnight, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as well, that has now been suspended. And again, I don't know what they're going to do there. You know, maybe they're just going to sort of crunch some more numbers and stuff and see what the situation there is. But, okay, so those numbers are just sort of, you know, numbers by themselves, 1 in a million, everything. Right, compare that to the contraceptive pill. Okay, so you can blood clots are also a side effect of taking the pill. So what are the risks of getting a blood clot while you're on the pill? And the answer to that, as somebody has come up with, is 1 in 1,000 to 2,000. Yeah.
And are we talking the potential for it to be a fatal blood
clot?
No,
we're just talking blood clots here.
Okay.
Okay. So not necessarily fatal. So with the COVID thing, the not necessarily fatal blood clots was 1 in 250,000.
Yeah.
Okay. So with the contraceptive pill, 1 in 1,000 to 2,000.
Okay.
Which is the same as tossing 10 heads a row, which is still pretty damn unlikely when you think about it.
But easier than tossing 18 heads in a row.
Indeed, you know, absolutely. So that's a risk factor of 0.05 to 0.1%.
Okay.
You know, so that's a significant number. And I'm sure a lot of, what do we call them, vaccine hesitant people out there.
Anti-vaxxers?
Well, no, apparently you're not meant to call them that anymore.
We're not meant to call them that anymore.
But I think, you know, there'll be a lot of those will be on the pill and will be... happily taking that risk of being on the pill, you know, which is enormous, you know, that's over 100, a factor of 100 at least, okay, more dangerous than the COVID vaccine, the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine. Deep vein thrombosis, that's another thing where you get clots and you get that from long distance flights, and so you've got a risk, again, round about 1 in 1,000 of getting that.
Yeah, so, I was going to say my mum has that, so I know all about it.
yeah, and so we live with risk every day. Shit, crossing the road is risky, you know, we know that. It's a matter of the size of that risk, the magnitude of that risk. And as I say, you know, people need to get their head around what the numbers actually mean. And, you know, that means comparing it to things that they can sort of have some everyday understanding of, like tossing coins and stuff.
And you were saying that humans are pretty bad at risk analysis. What? Where's the foundation of that statement? Oh, I just, in your day-to-day, is that?
I think I know I'm pretty bad at analysing risks for the most part.
Oh, same.
I think everyone
Is. Well, there you go. Yeah. Point proven.
Okay.
I wasn't
well,
sure if it was just a me thing.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to our next topic. So we're talking about experiments that have just completely gone against the rule book.
Well, yes and no. That's the thing. And so the physicists are pretty excited at the moment. Ooh, what's happening? There we go. Physicists are pretty excited at the moment. It takes a lot to get a physicist excited, I can tell you. So, right, a little bit of history. So the atom. Okay, we know the atom. The atom's great. Rutherford came along and said, right, the atom is made up of protons and electrons. And then later on, one of his students came along and found the neutron as well. So you've got the three fundamental, well, three building blocks of atoms. But 1936, this was sort of put on its head when somebody discovered a thing called the muon, which is sort of a relative of the electron. It's got the same negative charge as an electron's got, but it's 207 times the mass. So let's think of it as an electron on steroids, okay? But this muon is a fundamental particle, okay? And fundamental particles, by fundamental particles, we mean particles that can't be broken down to anything smaller, okay? So both the proton and the neutron, those constituents of the atoms, they can be broken down into still smaller things called quarks, which were named after... No, James Joyce, Ulysses, I think it came out of Ulysses, I think. But anyway, they've got all funny names. You've got an up quark and a down quark and a coloured quark and a charmed quark. And, God, what's the other? I can't remember. Flavoured quark, something like that. Anyway, but you've got now all of these new fundamental particles that people have discovered over the last 60 or 70-odd years, and they all go together in a thing called the Standard Model of Physics. And basically, we can explain pretty much everything with the Standard Model of Physics. The Standard Model of Physics is to physics what the periodic table is to chemistry, okay? You've got all your building blocks on this standard model, okay? And they had a thing called the Higgs boson that you may have heard of.
I've heard of that before.
Yeah.
That was a big one.
And this was one of the predictions of the Standard Model. So the Standard Model is very good at predicting things. So it predicted the fact that this Higgs boson particle should exist, and it was duly found and duly won the Discoverer's Nobel Prizes. It's also predicted the existence of these particles called gravitons that mediate gravity, because we don't know how gravity works yet, and nobody's yet discovered these gravitons. Okay, so this is the Standard Model of Physics. This is what the physicists work off, and it's worked pretty darn well up until around about 20-odd years ago when they did an experiment at Brookhaven National Labs in New York, and they were measuring what is called the magnetic dipole or the magnetic field or whatever you want to call it, all to do with magnetism of this thing called the muon, okay? And they found that the magnetic behavior of the muon wasn't quite what it should be as predicted by the Standard Model, okay? Now, it's a big, complicated experiment to do. It involves smashing up atoms and stuff like that and enormously expensive pieces of hardware, et cetera, et cetera. Now, they found that the numbers weren't quite right, but statistically speaking, it's statistics day to day, statistically speaking, they couldn't quite say this for definite. They couldn't say that this wasn't just a little bit of random noise that they were seeing, okay? And they thought, well, shit, this is interesting, but maybe we need to repeat this. So 20 years later, they've now gone to Fermilab, which is in Chicago, and they've done the same experiment, essentially, with better equipment, more precise, more accurate, et cetera, et cetera. And again, they found this anomaly. And they found this anomaly to a greater precision, but still not quite the precision that the physicists require to say that this is a new thing in physics, okay? And now, if this is a new thing in physics, that's the big if, then it's going to require people to rethink the Standard Model. It's going to kind of say that the Standard Model is wrong, that there's stuff in there that they're not taking account of, that there might be particles, new particles, that are interacting with these muons and causing this slight difference in these numbers. And this is really, really big. Now, the trouble is that... big experiment to do. They've only analysed 6% of the data from this experiment, and they reckon it's going to take them another year or two to analyse all of the data that has come out and hopefully get a more precise answer. At the moment, statistically speaking, they're at 1 in 40,000. they need to be at 1 in 3.5 million. Okay, so that's that 1 in 3.5 million is kind of your gold standard for the discovery of any sort of new effect in physics. So hopefully they will get there. And it's kind of unusual because they've taken the time to actually announce this seeming discovery at, you know, only 6% of the data has been analyzed. So my feeling is they've got to be pretty confident they're onto a real thing here. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone public with this. Now, there was a very famous example, must be about 10 or so years ago, when some folk in an Italian lab said that they had discovered particles that were traveling faster than the speed of light, these little neutrinos, and they were really going really rapidly. And as anyone who knows Einstein knows, things can't travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. And these guys said, well, these appear to be, and then they checked their setup, and there was a loose wire.
Oh, imagine being those scientists. It's heartbreaking.
If there's anything I've learned is that scientists are always just can't wait to share their discoveries.
Well, it's probably true because there's no prizes for second in science.
True.
There's no Nobel prizes for second, you know? So you got to be in first. The people who then check your results and confirm them, they don't get anything. So sadly, that's the way that, you're right, science does kind of work like that. And it's published first or, you know, or that's that. So we'll wait and see what happens with this. I think it's going to be very interesting. And if it does turn out to be true, then the physicists have got a lot of work to do. So, yeah.
Okay, and then for our last topic today, we're talking about Yuri Gagarin, who was a Russian astronaut.
Or cosmonaut, as they call them in Russia.
Sounds a lot cooler.
Yeah, I want to be a cosmonaut.
So, on April the 12th, 1961, which was 2 days ago, 60 years ago, humankind first left the planet and orbited it and came back safely. And that was this guy, Yuri Gagarin. And I just wanted to say that, you know, this is the anniversary of this, and this is something that we should all be celebrating, really. I think it's an extraordinary achievement. Imagine the bravery of that guy. You're sitting on top of this rocket filled with bloody liquid oxygen and everything like that, not knowing what the hell is going to happen. You get up there, you go around the Earth a couple of times, 108 minutes, that's how long the flight took, okay? So less than a couple of hours, and then he came back to Earth. He had to parachute out of his spacecraft, which was called Vostok 1, which means east in Russian. And the importance of this is shown by the fact that since his space flight, there's been a 20-year period when not all humans have been on Earth. So think about that.
That's
so
crazy.
Isn't it? I think that's an extraordinary statistic. So there's been people up above us for 20 of the last 60 years. I think that's quite amazing.
So 99.9999999% of our population is on Earth.
Yes, true. Yes, yes. But, and the really, really sad thing about Gagarin, so he did this in 1961. He died in 1967 at the age of 32, for goodness sake. And he died in a plane crash. So he was in the Air Force or whatever, the Russian Air Force, and it was just a run-of-the-mill sort of training flight or something like that, and he had a crash, and that was that. And this also gives me a chance to put my favourite band on BFM, because Prefab Sprout wrote a song about Yuri Gagarin. There we go.
Sick.
Oh, if we have any time, we should play it.
Yeah, I'll have a look. We might play it at the end of the show if we've got time. Sweet. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Alan.
Always a pleasure, you guys. Thanks.
No worries.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
So that was